to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today struggling epically with technology. Things are not going well today, but I will do my best to make it work. We should have Tom McDonald on the air. Tom, are you there? Okay. Well, we're doing what we can do. Today is Tuesday of Holy Week, and Holy Week is about things not going, at least by our worldly ideas. It's not about things going according to plan. So that's what's happening here today. Hang on. It looks like we may be getting this. Oh, and again, maybe not. I don't know. We're trying to make this work. At any rate, we were, as we're preparing for Good Friday and looking at the Passion, one of the things that comes up a great deal is the issue of the historicity of the Gospels. For some reason, people have, it's sort of like with the infallibility of the Pope. The Pope is the only person on planet Earth that people routinely say, I don't have to listen to a word he says unless he's speaking infallibly. Nobody talks that way about anybody else on Earth. Only the Pope gets this kind of treatment. And so even when the Pope is extremely knowledgeable about something, sure, he's not speaking infallibly, but, you know, it's generally a good idea to pay attention to people who are extremely knowledgeable about things. So, you know, we do this all the time with our doctor. You do it with your garage mechanic. You know, your garage mechanic says, yeah, I think you're going to need to replace that widget. Your doctor says, that sound that your chest is making is not supposed to be there, so we need to get you in to see a lung specialist. Nobody says, are you speaking infallibly here? Because if you're not, I can just feel free to just blow this off.
What's going on with are we having complete communication breakdown or any other Led Zeppelin songs?
What we have here is a failure to excommunicate. So yeah, I don't know. Our Skype network seems to have completely conked or something today. So we're struggling along, but Ethan is manfully minding the ship and making it all go.
So thanks, Obama.
What's that?
Thanks, Obama.
Yeah, I blame Obama.
I'm gonna miss him.
It was. He signed an executive order commanding that Skype go conk on Tuesday, just to invite everything.
So you sound like you're on a telephone too.
I am. Yes, we're grappling here. Skype did some. Offered an install update thing, which I neglected to update. So I don't know.
It's not working for me either.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, that's all right.
What were we talking about? I'm sorry, America.
Oh, that's okay. I was talking about this is the week when everybody subjects Scripture to the kind of scrutiny that no other book on planet Earth ever receives.
Nobody is going around asking, gee, did Caesar really fight the Gauls?
Well, and I would say, you know, before you came on, I mean, we do this with the Pope, too. It's like, it's only for Catholic things that we do these weird things. So the Pope is one of these people where, you know, unless he's speaking infallibly, people feel like, I don't have to pay any attention to what he says. What does he know, you know? And, you know, we never talk this way to our doctor. You know, there's a weird sound in your chest that shouldn't be there. I really think you should probably have that looked at. Well, are you speaking infallibly? Well, then never mind. You know?
Well, that was the point in the debate where they trot out this one like it's the first time anyone has ever heard it. Extraordinary right. claims require extraordinary evidence.
To which point is extraordinary claims require evidence. That's what they require.
Why did you raise the bar of evidence? And what is evidence? How is evidence more than evidence? How does it become extraordinary?
Extraordinary evidence.
Does it need to be notarized?
There are rumors that there is some sort of man-like hairy creature that lives in the jungle. Well, that's an extraordinary claim. It's going to require extraordinary evidence. Well, how about just evidence? Like we go out and we find a gorilla and bring it back and say, look, right. here it is. You know?
Right.
I don't know. I'm going to have to raise the bar even higher than that.
Right.
Why? You know?
I'm
sorry, go ahead.
I never understood that. That saying makes no sense at all, and the people who say it think they're very, very, very clever while they're saying it.
And so the same thing happens.
Carl Sagan, where did it come from?
I don't know. It's one of those weird things that people say that it sounds like it's really deep, but it doesn't mean anything. I mean, extraordinary claims. You know, it's an extraordinary claim to say that someone shot the president of the United States. That's an extraordinary event. But you know what? All you really need is like some footage.
Right.
And you don't need anything else other than that. I mean, and camera footage it's evidence. It's not extraordinary evidence. It's just someone took a picture of this event while it was happening. And so it turns out that yes, the claim that somebody shot President Kennedy really is established just by ordinary means. And this is how every trial in the world works.
Right.
Yeah, every murder trial. I mean, a murder is an extraordinary event. But you know what? We don't require extraordinary evidence. We just require evidence.
Right. Right. And, the evidence is multiple texts written by multiple independent authors. In ancient history, I can tell you as a historian that's a pretty sound basis for saying something happened, you know.
Right.
We don't put this burden on other things, and the only reason they do is because of what they consider the miraculous elements of it.
Right.
But even those miraculous elements, when we look at them, when we compare them to other Levantine religions and in any religious tradition anywhere,
right.
They don't strike us as absurdly profound, you know, like jumping on the blue bull and flying to the moon kind of stuff that we see in some mythologies. You know, it's not the giant snake of the world we've cut open and made man out of his blood. You know, there's something that appeals rationally to the stories that are in that scripture that don't sound like anything else.
Right. Well, that's one of the remarkable things about the Gospels is how restrained they are.
Yeah.
We can compare them with other Gospels.
Right, we can.
You know, we can compare them with 900-foot-tall Jesus, you know, emerging from the tomb, or, you know, these kinds of things, or you know, these sort of spectacular, kind of ramped-up Gospel comes very different from the canonical Gospels.
Well, I can tell you right off the top of my head, one of the sources I drew on for a piece I recently wrote was the Gospel of Peter, which has the cross speaking.
Yeah. That happens all the time.
Yeah, of course.
It's one of the things that struck me about the Gospels the first time I read them, and it's just that perception has just deepened as time has gone on. Sure, there are miracle stories in the Gospels, but they happen, the way they're told is remarkably restrained and undramatic. I mean, probably one of the most striking, for me, one of the most striking miracle stories is the story of the wedding at Cana. We're up against the break, but we will continue after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here with Tom McDonald. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here today with Tom McDonald, struggling, caught in the jaws of technology, making our lives ever easier until it kills us all. And
it really is true. Boy, I'm glad we have these things that can make everything convenient until they all break down and nothing can be done anymore. Just wait until Skynet comes online, you people. You'll
I just
see.
Paid for Skype to become self-aware. And then it will just host the radio show for me, and
and nobody will
tell me what
difference.
To say. So,
oh my.
So yeah. Well, anyway, we're talking before the break. By the way, if you want to join us out there in Radio Land, give us a call. We're at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. That is, I think you can call in that number. Although maybe we're dominating the phone lines, and you can't call in. Only Ethan knows these things. So, all right, good.
Cool.
So, anyway, but we were talking about the historicity of the Gospels. And I've mentioned this in the past. There's a really good book by a New Testament scholar named Richard Baucom,
yes.
who called Jesus and the Eyewitnesses. And he argues, I think very persuasively, that what you're looking at in the New Testament is very obviously eyewitness testimony written down either by witnesses themselves, or people who are very close to witnesses of the life of Jesus.
Or people acting as journalists and historians, which Luke makes from the very
right.
beginning of his gospel. Luke is very clear that I spoke to the people. You
right.
know, he says what he did. He went around and asked questions. And that's why when you have certain passages there, the fascinating thing about Luke is we actually hear the voice of Mary there, because you know, you sense in Luke that he spoke to the Blessed Mother.
Right.
And, you know, she kept these things in her heart. Well, that sounds like something she told him, doesn't it?
Right. And, of course, it's logic. If you want to know the circumstances of my birth, Tom, where would you turn? Would you turn to, for example, the book of Isaiah to learn about the circumstances of my birth? Well, no. Where are you going to turn? Who's the only possible source of information about the circumstances of my birth?
Carl Sagan?
What's that?
Obviously, your mother or your doctor.
It's got to be my mother or my pediatrician. Yeah.
Right.
Because they were the ones that were there, you know?
Right.
I was there, too, but I don't remember it. When we're looking at things like the birth narratives, we're looking at testimony that has to originate with the Blessed Virgin. It has to.
But see, you have a strain of scholarship. You look at some of them, even, if I'm remembering correctly, Raymond Brown, who are basically just rubbish the nativity accounts, that
yeah.
they're just pious fictions. If I'm remembering Birth of the Messiah correctly, I think he makes that claim in there.
Well, though, I mean...
Yeah, well, they're analyzing these things according to paradigms that they've set up, according to templates that they've established for reading text. And who says your template is correct? Who says your method of reading it is accurate? They say, well, the method
right.
tells us this. Well, where'd you get the method?
Right. All the best scholars, you know. But, not merely the... I mean, when we're talking about the Blessed Virgin, of course, we're talking about somebody who's probably very young...
Sure.
When she has Jesus, I mean, we're talking teens, probably.
Right, 15, 16.
She's not really all that old.
Right.
By the time the New Testament tradition starts to form.
Sure.
And she's, you know, she's around for a good long while. And this is also something interesting. You know, you'll often hear the Apostle Paul sort of pitted against the Blessed Virgin. Paul doesn't have any regard for women. He never mentions Mary, except for one sort of passing, you know, born of a woman, born under the law, he says to the Galatians.
Right.
And that's it for Marian piety in Paul's Gospels. Well, maybe. But remember, you know, that Paul's biggest disciple is the Apostle Luke,
sure.
or is the evangelist Luke. And Luke has a huge devotion to Mary. Where'd he get that from?
And maybe he didn't have anything to say. Paul didn't have anything on the subject of Mary.
Right. You know, well, the thing is that we forget that, you know, when the New Testament documents are being written, some of them are being written, like the Gospels are being written with, if you will, with future generations in mind. I'm writing these things down, Theophilus, so that you know the truth of what you've been taught. Theophilus just means... friend of God or lover of God. It doesn't necessarily have to refer to a person. And so he's talking to catechumens, and he's saying, you know, here, I'm writing this so that we'll have all of our ducks in a row in terms of what happened. What's the story here? That's what Luke's trying to do, is trying to get the story straight.
Right.
And, but when Paul's writing, I mean, he doesn't set out saying, I need to put together a corpus of 13, maybe 14 letters that will cover all of Christian doctrine. That's why I'm writing these letters.
Right.
He's writing these letters because he's got some pastoral fire he's got to put out. You know,
well,
stop to be with your mother, Corinthians. Don't get drunk at Mass, you know. And that's why he's writing these letters. He's just putting out pastoral fires. He's not laying out some sort of organized... history of Jesus' life among the apostles. And so you kind of get the gospel from him on a catch-as-catch-can basis. He's assuming you've already heard these stories.
Right.
And so he's not retelling them.
Well, and it's not a systematic theology. Romans is the closest you come to any kind of, you know, overarching
right.
system,
right.
if you want. But what he has is what we've spoken about here before, which is that all doctrine and dogma evolves out of confrontation with heresy. That until we know that somebody says Jesus is a creature, you know, made by God and subservient to God, we don't know. That we have to say, no
That's
way.
That's not what we think.
God's a Trinity, and then we have to talk about the two natures, and we have to establish this because this guy's not getting it. And that's what we have as early as Paul, is him, as you're saying, just kind of putting out fires, responding
just
to errors.
Just out fires.
Yeah. You know, and
so
these are letters. That's why they're letters. That's the form of the epistle, is I'm right. writing to you to encourage you and to teach you something, but also to correct something you're doing wrong, you know,
yeah.
and to remind you to bring me back my coat, you know, and weird stuff like that crops
yeah.
up.
Bring me my coat. And so what's intriguing about the Gospels to me is as much as what's, how should I put it, as important as the things that the Gospels say are, what's also important, in a curious way, are the things that they don't say.
Right.
So, for example, none of the Gospel, and this is, by the way, this is a feature, a super prominent feature of every fake Gospel, is you get a big, fat byline. I am, you know, Mary Magdalene. I am right. really... Honestly, Mary Magdalene, and I'm writing this gospel right now. This is me writing this thing. Yes, siree, Bob, right? You get this in all of the fake
Gnostic. Yeah.
They're always, you know, yeah, this is me. I'm Philip. I'm Thomas the Apostle. You know, sure, you can absolutely take that to the bank. What's really striking is none of the four gospels even bother to claim authorship.
Right.
They just don't even bother to. Why? Because everybody knows who stands behind these gospels.
Well, even
when you think about this too. Here's the other thing. What's really interesting is that the canonical gospels, two of the canonical gospels, are attributed to people. Imagine a biography of Reagan. By the way, we're separated in time. From the events of the Reagan administration by about the same amount of time that the gospel writers are separated in time, which wasn't that long ago, right?
Right.
Reagan wasn't all that long ago. But imagine some book comes out attributed to Reagan's barber. And, you know, nobody would really, like... be super interested in Reagan's barber per se, but here's the thing: the Luke and Mark are both not super important people in the early church.
No.
Mark, you know, Mark's actually got, you know, he's got a bit of a problem. I mean, Paul and Barnabas had a big fight about the guy. He chickened out on one apostolic mission. He's not the guy. If you're going to fake a gospel, you're not going to pick Mark as your author. It's like picking Reagan's barber. You know, you want to hear the thoughts of, you know, Reagan's Secretary of State or something.
Sure, they would have picked Peter or James or anybody.
Yeah, we're going to get some big name, right? Why is this attributed to Mark? Why is this attributed to Luke? Well, I have an explanation.
Because they wrote it.
Because they wrote it, right?
Well, the closest thing we get to attribution is with John, who says, you know, it is he who is writing this thing, and he never says who he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
because everybody already knows.
Yeah.
And this is because, you know, early Christians were not 2,000 years stupider than we are. when people came to them and said, this gospel is from John, they didn't say, oh, well, okay, we believe anything. you know, they trusted this gospel because they trusted the people that brought it to them. And these things, the gospels were not brought, you know, 50 years after they were authored, they begin to be circulated immediately.
Right.
I've seen the earliest fragment of the Gospel of John. It's in a library in Dublin called the Chester Beatty Library. Oh, we will be back after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with Tom McDonald. We're talking about the historicity of the Gospels and other stuff. And we will be back right after. And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we're here with Tom McDonald today. We're talking about a little bit about the historicity of the Gospels as we head into Holy Week. And you know, what really sticks out for me about the Gospels is, you know, that these read like eyewitness accounts. Theologized, to be sure, but how should I put it? I knew a Pentecostal pastor one time who was asked. He and a bunch of pastors were asked to come and pray for this little old lady because her family was convinced that she was demon possessed.
Oh,
and one of the pastors that got asked to participate in this thing was like, you know, yeah, right. Whatever,
really?
You know, and but he went along for whatever reason, you know, and in the middle of this session where they were praying for this, this is all Protestant Pentecostal pastors and so forth, but one of them was skeptical, but in the middle of praying for this little old lady who was, I mean, she was, you know, a little old lady, she reached behind her and she grabbed, the skeptical pastor happened to be standing behind her, and she kind of reached over her shoulders, or this little wizened old lady, and she grabbed this guy and she herked him right up off the ground.
Really?
And the Pentecostal pastor that I knew drolly remarked afterwards, that sort of thing changes your theology.
And then they called the Catholics, because it only works when you bring Catholics for this sort of thing.
So, you know, when you say that the Gospels are theologized, well, you know, yeah, seeing somebody rise from the dead does tend to have an impact on your philosophical outlook on the world.
That's why when we look back to the Old Testament models, the theologized history, even back to, you know, I've spent a great deal of time with Genesis, you know, first in grad school and even since then, and I wrote about it recently with Augustine in the National Catholic Register. And, you know, this Israel goes back throughout its history and rewrites it and understands it in different ways because they're encountering God in their history, and so they're developing both a history and a theology at the same time.
Right.
The idea of this pure scientific history, this is, first, it's new, you know, the idea of history as science. Second, it's bunk. It's an illusion. You can't find it. It doesn't exist. You can maintain the illusion of an academic history in which you believe you're being scrupulously confined to sources, but those sources in themselves were not scrupulous at all. And what you're doing will always be tainted by this bizarre thing called humanity. So the idea of an academic history that can arrive at a truth, and most historians understand this in the process of learning historiography in, you know, history school, but you still get this impression from them that, no, we're getting to the, we have to get past this to the real historical level. And they make noises in the direction of them understanding that that doesn't exist, but then they go on and do it anyway. You know, I can't tell you how much modern history I read where they're like, well, you know, we've got the bias, you know, these documents have inherent biases, but we're going to be able to peel aside using our method, they always have a method, and get to the true nut of what actually happened.
Yeah.
And I have no patience for it. You know, when I find a writer who can actually meet history in its place where you find it and talk about what people believed of themselves, you know, that's when you know you're dealing with a good historian.
Yeah, and part of it just is the fact that history is extraordinarily strange because it's a human story.
It's weird.
And the Gospels are, you know, reflect that. I mean, the people who experienced the life of Christ were themselves gobsmacked by it.
Sure.
They're not people. You get this notion. So I remember I've seen this done repeatedly. The kind of Old Testament checklist approach to the New Testament. You know, the Messiah will be born in Bethlehem. You know, and then you've got a passage out of Malachi or something, and then here's the New Testament fulfillment, and you just go down this checklist of all the stuff that the Messiah is going to do. Like the apostles had this checklist in their back pocket, and they were just wandering around going, well, you know, if my calculations are correct, he should, you know.
Right.
And they don't have any of that stuff in their mind. They're as gobsmacked as anybody. You know,
well, I can tell you the dumbest reduction of historical anti-historicism I've ever read was the belief that I have encountered that the Gospels are merely a midrash on Isaiah.
Okay.
Now, midrash is the way we kind of comment and sometimes use stories to explore the way rabbis used commentary and debate and different techniques and story to explore the meaning of an Old Testament text that was in dispute. So basically, this is just the world's greatest, most cryptic, most awesome rabbinical midrash that also tends to, you know, cast stones at certain members of the rabbinical elite, though.
Yeah.
And using rabbi in the wrong sense here.
Well, and that whole notion, I mean, that comes perilously close to the dumbest and yet most mysteriously popular fad of our time, which is the whole theory that Jesus never existed at all.
Yeah.
There was no Jesus. He was just this fictional character that was cooked up at some point by some people who just really enjoyed pain, I guess. I mean...
Guys, we don't have enough suffering yet. Let's make up a guy who they say is our Messiah so we can get killed faster.
Yeah, it was like, you know, really? Seriously? I mean, I find that incomprehensible. It just boggles my mind that anyone would look at, and remember, we're looking at remarkably realistic accounts with all kinds of historical detail in them.
Sure.
That arise 18 centuries before the invention of the novel.
Sure.
There's just,
not even the novel, but I remember somebody saying, well, if the gospel writers weren't telling what they saw, then they invented magical realism 2,000 years before Borges.
Yeah, it's just mind-boggling, you know, and this is what I'm talking about when I say, you know, nobody expects the Pope, everybody expects the Pope to constantly be speaking infallibly, but, you know, every time you run into, in the Gospels, you will inevitably find little bitsy details that are different. So Jesus says, you know, blessed are the poor in one Gospel, and he says, blessed are the poor in spirit in another Gospel. And, you know, the Gospels have slightly different words of institution for the Eucharist, which, you know, that's an incident that only happened, we know, only occurred once in the life of Christ.
Right.
So, you know, when we get one person saying, you know, this is my body, and another person saying, this is my body, which is for you, you know, and this kind of stuff. And people look at this and they say, that's it. There's just... these witnesses are, like, totally at odds. And it's like, you know, it's like looking at, you know, we mentioned JFK earlier. It's like looking at the assassination of JFK and saying that, you know, one person heard two shots and another person heard three shots. Therefore, JFK never existed.
Right.
Right. And the whole story of his assassination is a myth. And look, here's a record of him saying, you know, Ich bin ein Berliner, which means I am a jelly donut, and that proves that this is some kind of Eucharistic...
Yes, we shall use jelly donuts for the Eucharist.
A sacred meal myth, you know, that proves that JFK never existed. And it's like, or maybe like normal people... you have four different witnesses who are giving slightly varying accounts because different traditional language has been handed down to them in different liturgies, or they're making a particular point, and
right.
So they're slightly varying the language in order to make a point, but everybody knows that this is the common memory of the community. I mean, there's all kinds of much easier, much more rational ways of dealing with the Gospels than just saying, well, slight differences mean it all never happened.
Well, let's turn to the males for a minute then, because that's something I worked on recently that kind of provides a good segue to that, and it's mm-hmm. up at the National Catholic Register today, and it's called Was Jesus Really Nailed to the Cross? And what will surprise a lot of people, it surprised my wife, and I have a feeling it surprised a number of people, is the Bible never says he was nailed to the cross. We... if we look at it, Mark says, and they crucify him. Matthew says, when they had crucified him. Luke, there they crucified him. And John, there they crucified him.
Right.
And that's it. The word nail alone appears only once, and that is in the place where Thomas says he won't believe Jesus has risen until he sees the nail wounds in his hands. And when Jesus returns, he does not use the word nails, but he said probe the wounds. And later on, Paul mentions the act of nailing to a cross, but there's only two references whatsoever in all of Scripture, all of the New Testament, to nailing. So where do we get this whole nailing thing from? Well, I think Thomas is a good internal witness there. So when I see some people saying that the Gospels never say that Jesus was nailed to a cross, that's actually not true at all. I don't know how much more clear the passage in Luke of Thomas could be when he says, you know, oops, there we go.
Well, we're up against the break. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we'll be back with Tom McDonald in just a jiffy. And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here with Tom McDonald. We've been talking a bit about the historicity of the Gospels. We're saying before the break, one of the things that is simply notable about the Gospels is that they have the kinds of details that are obviously details that come from memory and not from imagination. Little things. The memory of John as an old man remarking that there was a lot of grass in the place where the miracle of the loaves and fishes took place. That's the kind of detail that you would get from, you know, Abe Simpson would remember something like that. And you get, you know, as I mentioned in the past, you also get details about figures who, if we're reading myth, you know, when you're reading a fictional, I mean, you see this reflected in the parables. Very rarely, in fact, only once, does Jesus in one of his parables name his characters. It's typically there was once a man who had two sons. you'll get those kinds of stories. There, you know, the kingdom of heaven is like a widow. But he doesn't bother to, you know, embellish the widow with a name. We only get that one time. And what's interesting is that the one time that we get Jesus telling a parable in which he names the character, mm-hmm. that character's name is Lazarus.
Right.
And it's a parable about a guy who is invited to come back from the dead. Or, you know, you have the rich man, and you'll notice that we sometimes hear that parable called the parable of Lazarus and Divas.
Divas, right.
Divas just means rich guy.
Yeah.
As in Divas in Misericordia, rich. But Lazarus is a real name. And how odd that you would get that parable told and the character would have that name. It's like Jesus is offering a sort of a contemporary commentary on current events.
Sure.
Shall we say this? You know, you can practically see him telling this parable as sitting around the dinner table after the resurrection of Lazarus.
Right, and we're told at one point that Lazarus was reclining at table with Jesus at, you know, at the house of Martha. I mean,
exactly
right. Given that scene in the scripture, that, you know, Lazarus is still there, and we're also told that they want to kill him.
Right, they want to kill him. So, when it's those odd little details, or the fact that we know the name of blind Bartimaeus.
Right.
Or the, one of the things that I find most powerful is just in passing, Mark mentions that Simon of Cyrene carried Jesus' cross, and that he tosses off, for his audience and his audience alone, he says Simon, of course, was the father of Alexander and Rufus. Well, you know, so what, right? Why are we told those two guys' names? We're told those two guys' names because the audience that he's writing to, the real flesh and blood audience that Mark knows, the church at Rome,
right.
know Alexander and Rufus. They know right. these guys. They're members of their community. You can
they're
see
sitting
Paul.
In the pews, as it were.
Yeah, they're seeing. So, you know, this, I'm not just making this stuff up. You talk to your fellow parishioners. Their dad was there. He was part of it, right? And you can see Paul at the end of his letter to the Romans says hello to Rufus.
Right.
That's
the funny stuff in, you find in Paul are these little details of bring me my extra cloak or something like that.
Right. Right. And so it's easy to forget because the distance in time between us is so enormous. We have this. We tend to shroud ancient documents in this kind of. Notion that they were written once upon a time,
right?
In cloud cuckoo land, and they don't the people involved in them weren't real people; they're Bible characters. Well, no. I mean, what you're doing is when you're reading the Gospels and when you're reading the New Testament, you're reading the testimony of a relatively small community that's scattered all over the Mediterranean world, and these guys know each other.
Sure.
You know, so. When Paul writes to the Corinthians about the resurrection, he says, you know, most of the people who witnessed the resurrection are still alive. You can go talk to them.
And if they weren't, there wouldn't have been much point for him to say.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's, as one historian said, you know, that's the kind of historical documentation that historians drool over. You don't get this kind of stuff out of antiquity. I can't think of any other event out of antiquity that has four primary eyewitness documents attesting it in language that's almost identical. I mean, the first three Gospels are called the Synoptics for a reason. Synoptic means seen with one eye. Partly it's because they're borrowing from one another. But, you know, they're not just borrowing from one another. They're also relying on independent sources. And they're telling the same story.
Right.
Over and over again, you know?
No, there is no other. I can tell you, in the ancient world, there is no other independent source that.
Yeah, there's nothing like it.
No, there really isn't.
But there are slight disagreements, and that means the whole thing can be thrown out.
Right. The fascinating thing is that we always hear about, you know, and this is Bart Ehrman's ridiculous thing, these few inconsistencies, most of which can be reconciled, such as the inconsistency on the date of the Day of the Passion in John, simply being that John was using a different calendar, you know, that
sure.
he had a different tradition. Everybody acts like, you know, April 1st, 2016 or whatever it is the same everywhere now because it almost is. It wasn't then.
Right. Well, you know, and that's one of the things that somebody wrote me the other day asking him, you know, how do we know what, you know, the Old Testament was, there are arguments about which books belong in the Old Testament. And here are these Jewish authors like Josephus, you know, and various other people, and they don't seem to recognize books that are in the Catholic Bible. And my response is, so what?
Right.
Because you're asking an anachronous question, like when you're talking about how Passover was observed. Well, there's lots of evidence to indicate that different Jews lived by different calendars and had different ways of observing Passover in the first century. A lot of what later will become solidified Jewish practice doesn't happen until after the destruction of the temple. Well, everything that's happening in the Gospels is all happening before the destruction of the temple.
Right. Well, and that's how one of the fascinating things is when they try to post-date certain statements of Jesus or certain Gospels after the destruction of the temple, because he's predicting the destruction of the temple, and he couldn't have predicted it unless it had already happened, so we have to put these books after 70 AD. I always... does the word prophecy not mean anything? I mean, I know you want to just eliminate that from consideration, but you actually... can't. You have no reason on which to do that.
And this is one of those things. I've got a friend who's a historian, a guy named Dave Kerp. He teaches at Ohio University. And he says, you know, I mean, as a historian, I look at something like that and I think you don't even necessarily need, like, divine prophetic powers to see that things are not going to end well.
Right.
For Jerusalem under Roman occupation, that you know, there's enough trouble already, even in Jesus' day, to see that this is going to come to a head sooner or later.
Right, it's already
and
it continued after too.
I mean, Jerusalem gets in the neck twice. I mean, you know, the temple is destroyed in 70, but then there's another uprising in 135.
See, but when we're talking about history, let's look at a figure. Let's look at Alexander the Great. Arian, his name is, not that Arius. He's not writing until about the 2nd century, and AD, and Alexander lived around the 4th century B.C.
Right.
You know, the earliest I think we have is Diodorus, which is only a little bit of a mention of Alexander, and that's sometime... about 200 years after the life and death of Alexander. So the details, written texts of the life of Alexander and the actions of Alexander come from 200 years after those actions took place. There's some monumental evidence. I won't pretend that there's not inscriptions that are found that are more coterminous with the life of Alexander. But when you come down to this, when we read about the Gordian knot, when we read about whatever incident of the life of Alexander we care to, we don't subject them to this kind of heightened skepticism. That,
right.
You know.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, golly, I think the oldest text that we have of Caesar's Gallic Wars dates from about 1,000 years after he wrote it.
And by the way, that's the only witness to the Gallic Wars. There is no other textual witness to that action.
Really?
And that's, if I'm recalling correctly, yes, that is the only textual.
Well, then it's impossible to know whether it really happened. I mean, who do we even know that there was such a person as Julius Caesar, really, when you think about it mentally?
Well, you know, if we look at Plutarch's Lives, maybe they were just theoretical.
They might have been myths, you know, that was based on...
Yeah, I don't see why we can't... Why can't we think that, too, if we're going to say, well, these are just, you know, idealized portraits of yeah. Greek and Roman figures that Plutarch used for, you know, like Plato used Atlantis.
Well, listen, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Tom. We will have our technology up and running next Tuesday. Until then, have a wonderful Easter. God bless you. And I will be back tomorrow with Rod Bennett. I want to thank Ethan Bullen for being our producer. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots here on Breadbox Media.